Chapter 4. The Teeth of Gwalior. Baffled wrath confused the brain of Conan the Cimmerian. He knew no more about how to go about searching for Muriela than he had known how to go about searching for the teeth of Gwalior. Only one thought occurred to him: to follow the priests. Perhaps at the hiding place of the treasure some clue would be revealed to him. It was a slim chance, but better than wandering about aimlessly. As he hurried through the great shadowy hall that led to the portico, he half expected the lurking shadows to come to life behind him with rending fangs and talons. But only the beat of his own rapid heart accompanied him into the moonlight that dappled the shimmering marble. At the foot of the wide steps, he cast about in the bright moonlight for some sight to show him the direction he must go. And he found it. Petals scattered on the sward told him where an arm or garment had brushed against a blossom-laden branch. Grass had been pressed down under heavy feet. Conan, who had tracked wolves in his native hills, found no insurmountable difficulty in following the trail of the Kashani priests. It led away from the palace, through masses of exotic-scented shrubbery where great pale blossoms spread their shimmering petals, through verdant tangled bushes that showered blooms at the touch, until he came at last to a great mass of rock that jutted like a titan's castle out from the cliffs at a point closest to the palace, which, however, was almost hidden from view by vine-interlaced trees. Evidently that babbling priest in Keshia had been mistaken when he said the teeth were hidden in the palace. This trail had led him away from the place where Muriela had disappeared, but a belief was growing in Conan that each part of the valley was connected with that palace by subterranean passages. Crouching in the deep, velvet-black shadows of the bushes, he scrutinized the great jut of rock which stood out in bold relief in the moonlight. It was covered with strange, grotesque carvings depicting men and animals and half-bestial creatures which might have been gods or devils. The style of art differed so strikingly from that of the rest of the valley that Conan wondered if it did not represent a different era and race, and was itself a relic of an age lost and forgotten at whatever immeasurably distant date the people of Alcmenon had found and entered the haunted valley. A great door stood open in the sheer curtain of the cliff, and a gigantic dragon's head was carved about it so that the open door was like the dragon's gaping mouth. The door itself was of carven bronze and looked to weigh several tons. There was no lock that he could see, but a series of bolts showing along the edge of the massive portal as it stood open told him there was some system of locking and unlocking, a system doubtless known only to the priests of Keshan. The trail showed that Gorulga and his henchmen had gone through that door, but Conan hesitated. To wait until they emerged would probably mean to see the door locked in his face, and he might not be able to solve the mystery of its unlocking. On the other hand, if he followed them in, they might emerge and lock him in the cave. Throwing caution to the winds, he glided through the great portal. Somewhere in the cavern were the priests, the teeth of Gwalior, and perhaps a clue to the fate of Muriela. Personal risks had never yet deterred him from any purpose. Moonlight illuminated for a few yards the wide tunnel in which he found himself. Somewhere ahead of him he saw a faint glow and heard the echo of a weird chanting. The priests were not so far ahead of him as he had thought. The tunnel debouched into a wide room before the moonlight played out, an empty cavern of no great dimensions, but with lofty vaulted roof, glowing with a phosphorescent incrustation, which, as Conan knew, was a common phenomenon in that part of the world. It made a ghostly half-light in which he was able to see a bestial image squatting on a shrine and the black mouths of six or seven tunnels leading off from the chamber. Down the widest of these, the one directly behind the squat image which looked toward the outer opening, he caught the gleam of torches wavering, whereas the phosphorescent glow was fixed, and heard the chanting increase in volume. Down it he went recklessly, and was presently peering into a larger cavern than the one he had just left. There was no phosphorus here, but the light of the torches fell on a larger altar, and a more obscene and repulsive god squatting toad-like upon it. Before this repugnant deity, Gorulga and his 10 acolytes knelt and beat their heads upon the ground, while chanting monotonously. Conan realized why their progress had been so slow. Evidently, approaching the secret crypt of the teeth was a complicated and elaborate ritual. He was fidgeting in nervous impatience before the chanting and bowing were over, but presently they rose and passed into the tunnel which opened behind the idol. Their torches bobbed away into the nighted vault, and he followed swiftly. Not much danger of being discovered. He glided along the shadows like a creature of the night, and the black priests were completely engrossed in their ceremonial mummery. Apparently they had not even noticed the absence of Gwaranga. Emerging into a cavern of huge proportions, about whose upward curving walls gallery-like ledges marched in tiers, they began their worship anew before an altar which was larger, and a god which was more disgusting than any encountered thus far. Conan crouched in the black mouth of the tunnel, staring at the walls reflecting the lurid glow of the torches. He saw a carven stone stair winding up from tier to tier of the galleries. The roof was lost in darkness. He started violently, and the chanting broke off as the kneeling blacks flung up their heads. An inhuman voice boomed out high above them. They froze on their knees, their faces turned upward with a ghastly blue hue in the sudden glare of a weird light that burst blindingly up near the lofty roof, and then burned with a throbbing glow. That glare lighted a gallery, and a cry went up from the high priest, echoed shudderingly by his acolytes. In the flash there had been briefly disclosed to them a slim white figure standing upright in a sheen of silk and a glint of jewel-crusted gold. Then the blaze smoldered to a throbbing, pulsing luminosity in which nothing was distinct, and that slim shape was but a shimmering blur of ivory.
"Yelaya!"
screamed Gwaranga, his brown features ashen.
"Why have you followed us? What is your pleasure?"
That weird, unhuman voice rolled down from the roof, re-echoing under that arching vault that magnified and altered it beyond recognition.
"Woe to the unbelievers! Woe to the false children of Keshia! Doom to them which deny their deity!"
A cry of horror went up from the priests. Gwaranga looked like a shocked vulture in the glare of the torches.
"I do not understand," he stammered. "We are faithful. In the chamber of the oracle you told us—"
"Do not heed what you heard in the chamber of the oracle,"
rolled that terrible voice, multiplied until it was as though a myriad voices thundered and muttered the same warning.
"Beware of false prophets and false gods. A demon in my guise spoke to you in the palace, giving false prophecy. Now hearken and obey, for only I am the true goddess, and I give you one chance to save yourselves from doom. Take the teeth of Gwalior from the crypt where they were placed so long ago. Alcmenon is no longer holy because it has been desecrated by blasphemers. Give the teeth of Gwalior into the hands of Thutmekri the Stygian to place in the sanctuary of Dagon and Derketo. Only this can save Keshan from the doom the demons of the night have plotted. Take the teeth of Gwalior and go. Return instantly to Keshia. There give the jewels to Thutmekri, and seize the foreign devil Conan and flay him alive in the great square."
There was no hesitation in obeying. Chattering with fear, the priest scrambled up and ran for the door that opened behind the bestial god. Gwaranga led the flight. They jammed briefly in the doorway, yelping as wildly waving torches touched squirming black bodies. They plunged onward, and the patter of their speeding feet dwindled down the tunnel. Conan did not follow. He was consumed with a furious desire to learn the truth of this fantastic affair. Was that indeed Yelaya, as the cold sweat on the backs of his hands told him? Or was it that little hussy Muriela turned traitress after all, if it was? Before the last torch had vanished down the black tunnel, he was bounding vengefully up the stone stair. The blue glow was dying down, but he could still make out that the ivory statue stood motionless in the gallery. His blood ran cold as he approached it, but he did not hesitate. He came on with his sword lifted and towered like a threat of death over the inscrutable shape.
"Yelaya,"
he snarled.
"Dead as she's been for 1,000 years. Ha!"
From the dark mouth of a tunnel behind him a dark form lunged, but the sudden deadly rush of unshod feet had reached the Cimmerian's quick ears. He whirled like a cat and dodged the blow aimed murderously at his back. As the gleaming steel in the dark hand hissed past him, he struck back with the fury of a roused python, and the long, straight blade impaled his assailant and stood out a foot and a half between his shoulders.
So?
Conan tore his sword free as the victim sagged to the floor, gasping and gurgling. The man writhed briefly and stiffened. In the dying light, Conan saw a black body and ebon countenance, hideous in the blue glare. He had killed Gwarunga. Conan turned from the corpse to the goddess. Thongs about her knees and breast held her upright against the stone pillar, and her thick hair, fastened to the column, held her head up. At a few yards' distance, these bonds were not visible in the uncertain light.
"He must have come too after I descended into the tunnel," muttered Conan. "He must have suspected I was down here." "So he pulled out the dagger?"
Conan stooped and wrenched the identical weapon from the stiffening fingers, glanced at it, and replaced it in his own girdle.
"And shut the door. Then he took Yelaya to befool his brother idiots. That was he shouting a while ago. You couldn't recognize his voice under this echoing roof. And that bursting blue flame, I thought it looked familiar. It's a trick of the Stygian priests. Thutmekri must have given some of it to Gwarunga."
The man could easily have reached this cavern ahead of his companions. Evidently familiar with the plan of the caverns by hearsay or by maps handed down in the priestcraft, he had entered the cave after the others, carrying the goddess, followed a circuitous route through the tunnels and chambers, and ensconced himself and his burden on the balcony while Gwarunga and the other acolytes were engaged in their endless rituals. The blue glare had faded, but now Conan was aware of another glow, emanating from the mouth of one of the corridors that opened on the ledge. Somewhere down that corridor there was another field of phosphorus, for he recognized the faint, steady radiance. The corridor led in the direction the priests had taken, and he decided to follow it rather than descend into the darkness of the great cavern below. Doubtless it connected with another gallery in some other chamber, which might be the destination of the priests. He hurried down it, the illumination growing stronger as he advanced, until he could make out the floor and the walls of the tunnel. Ahead of him and below, he could hear the priests chanting again. Abruptly, a doorway in the left-hand wall was limned in the phosphorus glow, and to his ears came the sound of a soft, hysterical sobbing. He wheeled and glared through the door. He was looking again into a chamber hewn out of solid rock, not a natural cavern like the others. The domed roof shone with the phosphorus light, and the walls were almost covered with arabesques of beaten gold. Near the farther wall, on a granite throne, staring forever toward the arched doorway, sat the monstrous and obscene Teor, the god of Pelishti, wrought in brass, with his exaggerated attributes reflecting the grossness of his cult. And in his lap sprawled a limp white figure.
"Well, I'll be damned," muttered Conan.
He glanced suspiciously about the chamber, seeing no other entrance or evidence of occupation, and then advanced noiselessly and looked down at the girl, whose slim shoulders shook with sobs of abject misery, her face sunk in her arms. From thick bands of gold on the idol's arms, slim gold chains ran to smaller bands on her wrists. He laid a hand on her naked shoulder, and she started convulsively, shrieked, and twisted her tear-stained face toward him.
"Conan!"
She made a spasmodic effort to go into the usual clinch, but the chains hindered her. He cut through the soft gold as close to her wrists as he could, grunting,
"You'll have to wear these bracelets until I can find a chisel or a file. Let go of me, damn it! You actresses are too damned emotional. What happened to you, anyway?"
"When I went back into the oracle chamber," she whimpered, "I saw the goddess lying on the dais as I'd first seen her. I called out to you and started to run to the door, then something grabbed me from behind. It clapped a hand over my mouth and carried me through a panel in the wall, and down some steps and along a dark hall. I didn't see what it was that had hold of me until I passed through a big metal door and came into a tunnel whose roof was alight like this chamber. Oh, I nearly fainted when I saw. They are not humans. They are gray, hairy devils that walk like men and speak a gibberish no human could understand. They stood there and seemed to be waiting, and once I thought I heard somebody trying the door. Then one of the things pulled a lever on the wall, and something crashed on the other side of the door. Then they carried me on and on through the winding tunnels and up stone stairways into this chamber, where they chained me on the knees of this abominable idol, and then they went away. Oh, Conan, what are they?"
"Servants of Bityakin," he grunted.
I found a manuscript that told me a number of things, and then stumbled upon some frescoes that told me the rest. Bityakin was a Pelishti who wandered into the valley with his servants after the people of Alcmenon had deserted it. He found the body of Princess Yelaya and discovered that the priests returned from time to time to make offerings to her, for even then she was worshipped as a goddess. He made an oracle of her, and he was the voice of the oracle, speaking from a niche he cut in the wall behind the ivory dais. The priest never saw him or his servants, for they always hid themselves when the men came. Bityakin lived and died here without ever being discovered by the priests. Crom knows how long he dwelt here, but it must have been for centuries. The wise men of the Pelishti know how to increase the span of their lives for hundreds of years. I've seen some of them myself. Why he lived here alone, and why he played the part of an oracle, no ordinary human can guess. But I believe the oracle part was to keep the city inviolate and sacred so that he could remain undisturbed. He ate the food the priests brought as an offering to Yelaya, and his servants ate other things. I've always known there was a subterranean river flowing away from the lake where the people of the Puntish Highlands throw their dead. That river runs under this palace. They have ladders hung over the water where they can hang and fish for the corpses that come floating through. Bityakin recorded everything on parchment and painted walls, but he died at last, and his servants mummified him according to instructions he gave them before his death, and stuck him in a cave in the cliffs. The rest is easy to guess. His servants, who were even more nearly immortal than he, kept on dwelling here, but the next time a high priest came to consult the oracle, not having a master to restrain them, they tore him to pieces. So since then, until Garulga, nobody came to talk to the oracle. It's obvious they've been renewing the garments and ornaments of the goddess as they'd seen Bityakin do. Doubtless there's a sealed chamber somewhere where the silks are kept from decay. They clothed the goddess and brought her back to the oracle room after Zargheba had stolen her. And oh, by the way, they took off Zargheba's head and hung it up in a thicket. She shivered, yet at the same time breathed a sigh of relief.
"You'll never whip me again."
"Not this side of hell," agreed Conan. "But come on, Gwarunga ruined my chances with his stolen goddess. I'm going to follow the priests and take my chance of stealing the loot from them after they get it. And you stay close to me. I can't spend all my time looking for you."
"But the servants of Bityakin," she whispered fearfully.
"We'll have to take our chance," he grunted. "I don't know what's in their minds, but so far they haven't shown any disposition to come out and fight in the open. Come on."
Taking her wrist, he led her out of the chamber and down the corridor. As they advanced, they heard the chanting of the priests, and mingling with the sound, the low, sullen rushing of waters. The light grew stronger above them as they emerged on the high-pitched gallery of a great cavern and looked down on a scene weird and fantastic. Above them gleamed the phosphorescent roof. 100 feet below them stretched the smooth floor of the cavern. On the far side, this floor was cut by a deep, narrow stream brimming its rocky channel. Rushing out of impenetrable gloom, it swirled across the cavern and was lost again in darkness. The visible surface reflected the radiance above. The dark, seething waters glinted as if flecked with living jewels, frosty blue, lurid red, shimmering green, and ever-changing iridescence. Conan and his companion stood upon one of the gallery-like ledges that banded the curve of the lofty wall, and from this ledge a natural bridge of stone soared in a breathtaking arch over the vast gulf of the cavern to join a much smaller ledge on the opposite side, across the river. 10 feet below it, another, broader arch spanned the cave. At either end, a curved stair joined the extremities of these flying arches. Conan's gaze, following the curve of the arch that swept away from the ledge on which they stood, caught the glint of light which was not the lurid phosphorus of the cavern. On that small ledge opposite them there was an opening in the cave wall, through which stars were glinting. But his full attention was drawn to the scene beneath them. The priests had reached their destination. There, in a sweeping angle of the cavern wall, stood a stone altar, but there was no idol upon it. Whether there was one behind it, Conan could not ascertain, because some trick of the light or the sweep of the wall left the space behind the altar in total darkness. The priests had stuck their torches into holes in the stone floor, forming a semicircle of fire in front of the altar at a distance of several yards. Then the priests themselves formed a semicircle inside the crescent of torches, and Garulga, after lifting his arms aloft in invocation, bent to the altar and laid hands on it. It lifted and tilted backward on its hinder edge, like the lid of a chest, revealing a small crypt. Extending a long arm into the recess, Garulga brought up a small brass chest. Lowering the altar back into place, he set the chest on it and threw back the lid. To the eager watchers in the high gallery, it seemed as if the action had released a blaze of living fire which throbbed and quivered about the open chest. Conan's heart leaped and his hand caught at his hilt, the teeth of Gwalior at last, the treasure that would make its possessor the richest man in the world. His breath came fast between his clenched teeth. Then he was suddenly aware that a new element had entered into the light of the torches and of the phosphorescent roof, rendering both void. Darkness stole around the altar except for that glowing spot of evil radiance cast by the teeth of Gwalior, and that grew and grew. The blacks froze into basaltic statues, their shadows streaming grotesquely and gigantically out behind them. The altar was laved in the glow now, and the astounded features of Garulga stood out in sharp relief. Then the mysterious space behind the altar swam into the widening illumination, and slowly with the crawling light, figures became visible, like shapes growing out of the night in silence. At first they seemed like gray stone statues, those motionless shapes, hairy, manlike, yet hideously inhuman. But their eyes were alive, cold sparks of gray icy fire. And as the weird glow lit their bestial countenances, Garulga screamed and fell backward, throwing up his long arms in a gesture of frenzied horror. But a longer arm shot across the altar, and a misshapen hand locked on his throat. Screaming and fighting, the high priest was dragged back across the altar. A hammer-like fist smashed down, and Garulga's cries were stilled. Limp and broken, he sagged across the altar, his brains oozing from his crushed skull. And then the servants of Bityakin surged like a bursting flood from hell on the black priests who stood like horror-blasted images. Then there was slaughter, grim and appalling. Conan saw black bodies tossed like chaff in the inhuman hands of the slayers, against whose horrible strength and agility the daggers and swords of the priests were ineffective. He saw men lifted bodily and their heads cracked open against the stone altar. He saw a flaming torch grasped in a monstrous hand thrust inexorably down the gullet of an agonized wretch who writhed in vain against the arms that pinioned him. He saw a man torn in two pieces as one might tear a chicken, and the bloody fragments hurled clear across the cavern. The massacre was as short and devastating as the rush of a hurricane. In a burst of red, abysmal ferocity, it was over, except for one wretch who fled screaming back the way the priests had come, pursued by a swarm of blood-dabbled shapes of horror which reached out their blood-smeared hands for him. Fugitive and pursuer vanished down the black tunnel, and the screams of the human came back dwindling and confused by the distance. Muriela was on her knees, clutching Conan's legs, her face pressed against his knee and her eyes tightly shut. She was a quaking, quivering mold of abject terror. But Conan was galvanized. A quick glance across at the aperture where the stars shone, a glance down at the chest that still blazed open on the blood-smeared altar, and he saw and seized the desperate gamble.
"I'm going after that chest," he grated. "Stay here."
"Oh, Mitra, no!"
In an agony of fright, she fell to the floor and caught at his sandals.
Don't leave me!"
"Lie still and keep your mouth shut,"
he snapped, disengaging himself from her frantic clasp. He disregarded the torturous stare. He dropped from ledge to ledge with reckless haste. There was no sign of the monsters as his feet hit the floor. A few of the torches still flared in their sockets. The phosphorescent glow throbbed and quivered. And the river flowed with an almost articulate muttering, scintillant with undreamed radiances. The glow that had heralded the appearance of the servants had vanished with them. Only the light of the jewels in the brass chest shimmered and quivered. He snatched the chest, noting its contents in one lustful glance, strange, curiously shapen stones that burned with an icy, non-terrestrial fire. He slammed the lid, thrust the chest under his arm, and ran back up the steps. He had no desire to encounter the hellish servants of Bityakin. His glimpse of them in action had dispelled any illusion concerning their fighting ability. Why they had waited so long before striking at the invaders, he was unable to say. What human could guess the motives or thoughts of these monstrosities? That they were possessed of craft and intelligence equal to humanity had been demonstrated, and there on the cavern floor lay crimson proof of their bestial ferocity. The Corinthian girl still cowered on the gallery where he had left her. He caught her wrist and yanked her to her feet, grunting,
"I guess it's time to go."
Too bemused with terror to be fully aware of what was going on, the girl suffered herself to be led across the dizzy span. It was not until they were poised over the rushing water that she looked down, voiced a startled yelp, and would have fallen but for Conan's massive arm about her. Growling an objurgation in her ear, he snatched her up under his free arm and swept her in a flutter of limply waving arms and legs across the arch and into the aperture that opened at the other end. Without bothering to set her on her feet, he hurried through the short tunnel into which this aperture opened. An instant later they emerged upon a narrow ledge on the outer side of the cliffs that circled the valley. Less than 100 feet below, the jungle waved in the starlight. Looking down, Conan vented a gusty sigh of relief. He believed he could negotiate the descent, even though burdened with the jewels and the girl, although he doubted if even he, unburdened, could have ascended at that spot. He set the chest, still smeared with Garulga's blood and clotted with his brains, on the ledge, and was about to remove his girdle in order to tie the box to his back when he was galvanized by a sound behind him, a sound sinister and unmistakable.
"Stay here,"
he snapped at the bewildered Corinthian girl.
"Don't move."
And, drawing his sword, he glided into the tunnel, glaring back into the cavern. Halfway across the upper span, he saw a gray, deformed shape. One of the servants of Bityakin was on his trail. There was no doubt that the brute had seen them and was following them. Conan did not hesitate. It might be easier to defend the mouth of the tunnel, but this fight must be finished quickly before the other servants could return. He ran out on the span, straight toward the oncoming monster. It was no ape, neither was it a man. It was some shambling horror spawned in the mysterious, nameless jungles of the south where strange life teemed in the reeking rot without the dominance of man, and drums thundered in temples that had never known the tread of a human foot. How the ancient Pelishti had gained lordship over them, and with it eternal exile from humanity, was a foul riddle about which Conan did not care to speculate, even if he had had opportunity. Man and monster, they met at the highest arch of the span, where 100 feet below rushed the furious black water. As the monstrous shape with its leprous gray body and the features of a carven inhuman idol loomed over him, Conan struck as a wounded tiger strikes, with every ounce of thew and fury behind the blow. That stroke would have sheared a human body asunder, but the bones of the servant of Bityakin were like tempered steel. Yet even tempered steel could not wholly have withstood that furious stroke. Ribs and shoulder bone parted and blood spouted from the great gash. There was no time for a second stroke. Before the Cimmerian could lift his blade again or spring clear, the sweep of a giant arm knocked him from the span as a fly is flicked from a wall. As he plunged downward, the rush of the river was like a knell in his ears, but his twisting body fell halfway across the lower arch. He wavered there precariously for one blood-chilling instant, then his clutching fingers hooked over the farther edge and he scrambled to safety, his sword still in his other hand. As he sprang up, he saw the monster, spurting blood hideously, rush toward the cliff end of the bridge, obviously intending to descend the stair that connected the arches and renew the feud. At the very ledge, the brute paused in mid-flight, and Conan saw it too. Muriela, with the jewel chest under her arm, stood staring wildly in the mouth of the tunnel. With a triumphant bellow, the monster scooped her up under one arm, snatched the jewel chest with the other hand as she dropped it, and, turning, lumbered back across the bridge. Conan cursed with passion and ran for the other side also. He doubted if he could climb the stair to the higher arch in time to catch the brute before it could plunge into the labyrinths of tunnels on the other side. But the monster was slowing, like clockwork running down. Blood gushed from that terrible gash in his breast, and he lurched drunkenly from side to side. Suddenly he stumbled and reeled and toppled sideways, pitched headlong from the arch and hurtled downward. Girl and jewel chest fell from his nerveless hands, and Muriela's scream rang terribly above the snarl of the waters below. Conan was almost under the spot from which the creature had fallen. The monster struck the lower arch glancingly and shot off. But the writhing figure of the girl struck and clung. and the chest hit the edge of the span near her. One falling object struck on one side of Conan and one on the other. Either was within arm's length. For the fraction of a split second, the chest teetered on the edge of the bridge, and Muriela clung by one arm, her face turned desperately toward Conan, her eyes dilated with the fear of death, and her lips parted in a haunting cry of despair. Conan did not hesitate, nor did he even glance toward the chest that held the wealth of an epoch. With a quickness that would have shamed the spring of a hungry jaguar, he swooped, grasped the girl's arm just as her fingers slipped from the smooth stone, and snatched her up on the span with one explosive heave. The chest toppled on over and struck the water 90 feet below, where the body of the servant of Bityakin had already vanished. A splash, a jetting flash of foam, marked where the teeth of Gwalior disappeared forever from the sight of man. Conan scarcely wasted a downward glance. He darted across the span and ran up the cliff stair like a cat, carrying the limp girl as if she had been an infant. A hideous ululation caused him to glance over his shoulder as he reached the higher arch to see the other servants streaming back into the cavern below, blood dripping from their bared fangs. They raced up the stair that wound up from tier to tier, roaring vengefully, but he slung the girl unceremoniously over his shoulder, dashed through the tunnel, and went down the cliffs like an ape himself, dropping and springing from hold to hold with breakneck recklessness. When the fierce countenances looked over the edge of the aperture, it was to see the Cimmerian and the girl disappearing into the forest that surrounded the cliffs.
"Well," said Conan, setting the girl on her feet within the sheltering screen of branches, "we can take our time now. I don't think those brutes will follow us outside the valley. Anyway, I've got a horse tied at a waterhole close by, if the lions haven't eaten him." "Crom's devils, what are you crying about now?"
She covered her tear-stained face with her hands, and her slim shoulders shook with sobs.
"I lost the jewels for you," she wailed miserably. "It was my fault. If I'd obeyed you and stayed out on the ledge, that brute would never have seen me. You should have caught the gems and let me drown."
"Yes, I suppose I should," he agreed. "But forget it. Never worry about what's past. And stop crying, will you? That's better. Come on."
"You mean you're going to keep me? Take me with you?"
she asked hopefully.
"What else do you suppose I'd do with you?"
He ran an approving glance over her figure and grinned at the torn skirt, which revealed a generous expanse of tempting ivory-tinted curves.
"I can use an actress like you. There's no use going back to Keshia. There's nothing in Keshan now that I want. We'll go to Punt. The people of Punt worship an ivory woman, and they wash gold out of the river in wicker baskets. I'll tell them that Keshan is intriguing with Thutmekri to enslave them, which is true, and that the gods have sent me to protect them for about a house full of gold. If I can manage to smuggle you into their temple to exchange places with their ivory goddess, we'll skin them out of their jaw teeth before we get through with them.